Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Richard Rossi Live. I'm really excited to have a friend of mine from high school, Ruth Johnston, who's written a fascinating book that will help you understand that question, who are you? It gets into personality theory, it gets into the mind, it gets into Jung, it gets into a lot of interesting stuff. So we'll be back with my friend Ruth to discuss her book. Her book is entitled Remodeling the Mind, Personality and Balance, and it's available on Amazon. And wherever you get books, look for her book, and we'll be back to talk about it in this fascinating 30-minute interview. Thanks for tuning in. Welcome back to Richard Rossi Live, and welcome to my friend from high school, Ruth Johnston, who we were friends when we were kids years ago.
I know. Well, I was about 17. It's a long time.
Well, I'm just so proud of you. This book is fantastic. I'm really delving into it. So remodeling the mind, and you have a hyphen for remodeling. How did you pick this title?
Well, I wanted to kind of evoke two ideas at the same time. A lot of self-help books are asking you to sort of remodel yourself, like you're your own kitchen. You know, put in marble countertops and fix yourself up. And there's some of that idea in it, but at the same time, I wanted to suggest the idea that you need to think differently about why you do things, and that just coming to understand a sort of a working model of how your personality makes decisions and reacts to the world can help you understand enough that, you know, either it'll help you fix some problems in your life that you aren't happy with, or just come to understand why you're doing things and maybe see that some of the things you thought were weaknesses are really just ways that you cope and are perfectly okay. So remodeling in the one way and coming up with a new model in the other.
Mm. Yeah, I'm mindful of a verse in Corinthians that talks about who knows a man, you know, except the spirit of that man. And it seems like sometimes we find ourselves doing things and we don't even know why we're doing it, you know, whether it's our genetics or the parents or, you know, just something instinctive or hormonal. Or do you think it's hard sometimes to even know why we do the things we do?
I think especially in midlife, you know, maybe young people have that difficulty too, but I think they usually just kind of assume that what they're doing makes sense. When you get into your late 30s and your 40s and your 50s, you start to find things in your life that aren't adding up the way you thought they were going to. You know, you thought you knew how life was going to go. You made decisions earlier. And you find yourself with things that just aren't going right. You have a child that was supposed to be your pride and joy, and instead they're doing something different, whatever it is. And sometimes the scripted thing you thought you would be doing, if someone had gone back when you were 25 and said, hey, imagine you're 42, and this is the stuff that's going on, you'd say, oh, I'd handle it like this. But in fact, there you are at 42, you're not handling it like that at all. You're doing something you wouldn't have expected, and sometimes you just don't know what to do, and you end up just doing things. And so, yeah, sometimes we understand why we do things, and other times, you can start to feel like you're driven by things that are larger than you, and yet they're within you.
Mm.
I think this book really came out of some of those years for me, finding some things like that, being put in difficult positions and beginning to have a sense that we're not even really in our own control, in a sense. There's so much going on inside.
So some of this stuff, it's kind of like instinct or what, you know, scientists would call adaptive behavior, just ways that we kind of automatically respond or go into fight or flight, that type of thing?
Yeah. One of the key ideas that I'm suggesting here is that instead of looking at personality as a sort of a list of traits, you know, you're outgoing, you're smart, you're, things like that is how we usually think of it. I want to suggest a working model that has some parts of your mind and your personality sort of fixed and inborn, like animal instinct, and other parts of your mind and personality that are flexible and able to learn easily. And to really understand someone's personality and why they come up against things that they just can't do or just have to do, you really need to study those inborn animal instinct parts that they can't even explain why they believe certain things. If you ask somebody, they'll just say, well, it's because it's this way. You know, it's like asking your cat why it runs away from a UPS truck. You know, it doesn't know. It just knows that that brown truck is, you know, is bad news and it's time to get away. And people have things like that. And I think a lot of what Jung was writing about, you know, back in the 1920s and forward was the effect of this kind of sort of fixed inborn thinking in people.
Mm. So. Yeah, you really, I love what you do with Joseph Campbell's work, Jung, the archetypes, and a lot of the filmmakers listening. One of the books that have been very influential here in Hollywood is his book on myths and on the hero's journey. So the archetypes in your book, you use that to talk about inborn knowledge, and you talk about these different types, the prince, the knight. What would you want to, you mentioned film a lot in your book, why don't you talk about that, because we have a lot of actors listening, film buffs, how these films kind of illustrate some of the archetypes, sensing,
right,
intuition, thinking, feeling.
Okay, sure. Yeah, as you mentioned, you know, Joseph Campbell's work on archetypes, usually when you use the word archetype, people think of exactly that kind of thing. They think of the hero on his quest, sort of fairy tale folklore archetypes, the king, the wizard, the knight, the princess, and they think that if I said to somebody, you have a lot of archetypes in your mind, they would assume that I mean exactly those roles. And sometimes that is what I mean, but there are some other kinds of archetypes, as you said, with sensing, intuition, thinking, and feeling. These are the basic thought processes that Jung divided out, and each one has a way that it can be archetypal. That is, that it's going to be inborn, idealistic, just feels like it knows what life is about, and really resistant to learning. So the first one, you know, sensing, is pretty much a lot about the archetypes, the roles, you know, the king, the knight, so on. There are so many movies that illustrate that. Of course, there's Star Wars that everybody talks about. That I think, didn't George Lucas sort of lean on that book?
Yeah, he was very influenced by Joseph Campbell. Yes.
And so you have these people that play these roles, you know, and they really do things according to what the role calls for. Sometimes the roles are not the fairy tale and folklore kind, and they can be a little bit harder to see at first, but are just as influential. Going back before Joseph Campbell, back to 1939, and Frank Capra did Mr. Smith Goes to Washington.
Mm-hmm.
I think probably most people have seen that. Is it good to give a little recap on what's in the movie?
I think so. I mean, that was a year, the probably the greatest year in film history. You had The Wizard of Oz,
really?
And Gone with the Wind, and Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, and Young Mr. Lincoln. It was a year in which just all these great movies, and that is one of the best, you know. And your book on page, by the way, if you're listening, get the book. It's Remodeling the Mind, Personality and Balance, Ruth Johnson. in on page 140, 141, you get into Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, Jimmy Stewart. And how does that, for you, illustrate these archetypes?
Well, the interesting thing is, you know, of course, the basic plot is, you know, a young and experienced man becomes a senator, just an interim appointment for a few months. He goes, he doesn't know what's going on, and he finds out that there's a lot of corruption. But the movie is really designed around a lot of sort of classic visual role ideas. For instance, one of the really notable things, when Mr. Smith arrives in Washington, instead of going off where he's ever supposed to be, he just gets on a tour bus. Mm-hmm. And he just begins riding around because he's bowled over by all of the iconic images. And in a democracy, you know, we don't have a king with a throne and all these kinds of images of authority. Our images of authority and sort of the archetype of a king are our monuments, our documents, our great people. So it's like he's going around and looking at sort of the archetype of the king, true authority, and seeing all these things. And then he kind of takes on the role. He's going to be the knight that fights for things. And then the primary conflict is that the older senator is actually nicknamed the Silver Knight. They use some of these archetypes very openly in the film. But he's no longer a true knight. He's now corrupt. He's not really upholding the true authority, in a sense, you know, the true king, the Gettysburg Address and the, you know, Declaration of Independence. Instead, he's working for money. And so all through it, Mr. Smith keeps saying, how can we tell the children that there's this corruption going on? And that calls in another archetype. None of the children are really characters themselves, but as a group, they're a very powerful force. They're the innocent children who believe in all the ideals, and it will just hurt them terribly if they have to find out that the archetype of good government and the king is actually corrupt, and the archetype of the Silver Knight is actually corrupt. We can't have that happen. So really, the story is about how the archetypes win, in a sense. The final, you know, wrapping up the conclusion is when the Silver Knight realizes that he's been corrupt, and he confesses, and he changes, and he doesn't want to do that anymore, and he returns to the path of the good knight to restore good government and, in a sense, the rule of the true king. And that protects the innocent children from having to find out, you know, just how bad it was. And so the people fit into their archetypal roles instead of clashing with them. And that's the happy ending, is that all the people have returned to what their archetypal roles tell them they should be doing. And really, that is the main happy ending of that. It doesn't show anything else getting solved, but the archetypes win.
Hmm. Those archetypes are so powerful. I guess maybe Jung or Campbell was right. They're subconscious, because when I watch his films, Frank Capra, I get emotional, and you know, whether it's that one or Wonderful Life at the end, where he all the friends rally around the same actor, Jimmy Stewart. Or we watched one called Meet John Doe by the same director, and it was the same thing at the very end, a lot of archetypes, and we were crying, and you know, those archetypes, do you think they're transmitted somehow genetically in our, I mean, do you think he's right about the collective unconscious and all that?
Well, you know, that's one of those things. I wish that we could prove scientifically that it was one way or another, because, you know, we've really come into a time where we like to see things proven, like to see scans or something like that. At the moment, we just have to kind of go on what's probable. And it does seem like, since animals are born with instincts that include, the other day on Facebook, I saw a hilarious video where people put a cucumber next to a cat. And it's just a cucumber. But the minute the cat registers the shape, it just springs in the air about 4 feet. And it's very clear when you watch this montage of all these cats just, you know, scared out of their wits by a cucumber, that even if they've never seen a snake, there's something in their mind that knows what a snake looks like and is ready to be frightened if they ever encounter one. And that's really, I think, what Jung was talking about when he was thinking about collective unconsciousness and archetypes, that there are these, just, it's not a real idea, but there's sort of an inborn shape, the possibility of things. And you know, it's not just the social roles, and you mentioned It's a Wonderful Life, and I want to get back to that in a minute. But I want to talk first about how the archetypes, the social role archetypes, like king or cop or good guy or villain, you know, they can be used in a straightforward way, mm-hmm. but they can also be used in an opposite way. And that's where you get into film noir. And mm-hmm. they're giving a very different message about mm-hmm. archetypes.
Yeah, you bring up Double Indemnity, which is probably maybe the greatest film noir example. With Fred McMurray, Barbara Stanwyck.
Right. And it's, Fred McMurray is great in that role because he looks like such a nice guy. He's mm-hmm. like a Mr. Rogers. You can't believe that he's doing something bad.
We have that memory of him, a lot of us baby boomers, of him being this really good guy, like My Three Sons, and a lot of the old Disney films, The Son of Flubber and
right.
Aftermath of Professor. You know, he was dad, you know, and all of a sudden you see this old film. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And really, I think they're using that on purpose because another type of inborn knowledge that people can have is actually the opposite of accepting these archetypal roles. And it's a kind of suspicion of them because, in a sense, the inborn idea that's most dear to them is this, a sense of true truth, the truest meaning, the real truth. It has to be uncovered at a sort of a general sense that most of the time, most people are trying to hide the truth from you. And they may do it by stonewalling you for information, or they may do it by looking really innocent, like Fred McMurray. And so I think that movie is really exploring that idea because Fred McMurray looks like he should be the knight archetype. He's the insurance guy who helps people be safe. He's the nice guy with the benevolent face. And yet, he's not being a knight. He's not fighting for the innocent or anything like that. He's done something wrong. And then Barbara Stanwyck she doesn't look really innocent, I guess. But she's presented as a wife and a mother, you know, and those things. The archetype of a mother should be somebody that's taking care of you and helping you. And it turns out she's not much of a mother. She's a stepmother. And behind that image of a mother, she's hiding a lot of neglect and a lot of hatred. And so the appearances turn out to be deceiving. And the real knight, in a sense, in Double Indemnity is Barton Keyes, the insurance investigator.
Yeah, Edward G. Robinson, who that was kind of a flip-flop, too, because he was playing gangsters before that, and all of a sudden he's the good guy.
Well, see, that's perfect, because they're playing again with the appearances. He doesn't look like a knight. He doesn't have that benevolent glow to him that Fred McMurray does, and he's kind of dumpy, and yet he's the guy who's seeking truth. He's not going to rest until he's found the truth. Mm. And they keep telling, Fred McMurray keeps trying to tell him, you know, no, there's nothing to see here. And you remember what he keeps saying? That there's a little man inside.
Yeah, a little man talks to him. And that's kind of like the conscience, the still small voice.
Right. It's his intuition inside. And to me, that's a way of personifying this sort of inborn archetype of true meaning, that instead of being focused on the appearances of saying, oh, well, this person looks good, so they must be good. He's got this worrying thing that says, no, there's a really true truth in there somewhere, and I can't see it, and I've got to find it. So it's the little man inside that keeps telling him something doesn't feel right until he has peeled away the layers of deception, pulled off the masks, stripped away the disguises. And that's really, you know, to connect it directly to Jung, one of the mental functions that he talks about is intuition. And really this the little man inside is sort of an archetypal way of having intuition, of really feeling that there's something there and you got to find it and, you know, you'll ferret it out. So I would actually consider his search for truth to be searching for a type of archetype. It's just not what we usually think of like a role, like a king or a knight or a villain. It's a very different kind of idea that's inborn in him, which is, I have to find the truth.
Hmm. I wonder if the Barbara Stanwyck, I don't know all the archetypes list that different people would say, but that seems like an archetype too. You know, you have Cinderella has the wicked stepmother, or the femme fatale, that, you know, this black widow woman who is a dangerous seductress in the Bible. You have the Delilah that, you know, seduces Samson and he comes to ruin, or, you know, because Fred McMurray does seem like fairly decent but she, you know, kind of corrupts him. He goes for the bait. I mean, do you know, is that an archetype, that kind of, you know, seductress?
I'm sure. And in a sense, when we're looking at archetypes as roles that people can fulfill, there's really any number of them. The archetypal thing is just the tendency to look at people in a role and expect them to fill the role, whatever it is. If they look like they're bad, you expect them. There's a guy in Double Indemnity who looks like he's going to be terrible. He looks like he's the criminal that they want to pin it on or something. And in the end, he turns out to be true to his true love or something. And so, in a sense, they're using the archetypes in a straightforward way, like you said, the bad girl. And in another sense, I don't know how consciously they would have thought about this. I'm really using the movie to draw out what I'm trying to look for, which is that an archetypal idea doesn't have to be just the human role. It could be something else. In this case, the search for meaning. So I think it's using it both ways.
Mm. Now, how about thinking and feeling? Any movies come to mind for those?
Yeah. Well, you mentioned It's a Wonderful Life. That one, I watched it again recently, and I was really struck by how well it goes into what I would consider an archetypal way of using logic and numbers. Thinking in personality terms means the use of logic, use of numbers in a logical way. And in particular, when it's an archetypal way of thinking, it's looking at logic and numbers not just as anything goes, but as using them in a moral way and doing things in the right order. And so it's a very deeply moral thing. It's a root of conscience to use this kind of inborn archetypal idealistic thinking. And that's really what It's a Wonderful Life is about. There's a number of ways in which it has this. You know, you have George Bailey, and he wants to travel the world. But because he's the oldest son, he has to go work at the bank first.
Mm-hmm.
So just because he's you know, in age order, he's first, he has a duty to do this. And so in a sense, there's sort of a logical, numerical thing going on. And then these things keep happening to prevent him from going off and doing what he wants to do. And he keeps sticking to his duty. And then you have all of the business about the savings and loan, in which they're using money and numbers in a moral way to try to help people get homes. Whereas, mm-hmm. I've lost the name of the bad guy.
Potter. Yeah, he was
Mr.
played
Potter.
By from the great acting family, Lionel Barrymore.
Oh, okay. Cool. I didn't see you know more about movies than I do. That's great. yeah, and he uses numbers and money in just a really immoral way. He's not doing them to do anything good. He's just doing them to get them to add up to the highest sum possible.
Mm.
Whereas
I get so mad at him when he gets the money in the newspaper. Do you remember that part? And he has the money that Uncle Billy misplaces, and he wheels away with it. Oh, just, oh. Gets even though I've seen it 100 times, I get so upset every time.
Still want to smack him. Yeah, yeah, I mean, just outright theft. At first, like, he's just chiseling people and overcharging rents, and then finally he stoops to just flat-out theft and lies. You know, but the savings and loan, what they stand for in the town is that they're using logic and numbers for a moral purpose in an idealistic way. Also logic, not just numbers. Logic is part of thinking, and logic is also shown in sort of an idealistic moral light, because when George Bailey gets to see what the world looks like with him not in it, there are all these things where, because you weren't there to do this, these things happened. Because you weren't there to save your brother, not only did your brother die, but all the people your brother would have saved, they also died. And so logic, too, is presented in a very solidly sort of right and wrong, idealistic moral foundation. And
wow,
that's
a real insight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so at the end, the big happy ending is not just that George Bailey begins to see this and see that it really, you know, he wasn't valuing these moral logic and moral numbers things enough. He comes back to his life and he finds that all the people have been finding numbers in a sense. What he needs to save him is $8,000 made up of, you know, any small sum. And they're throwing it all in a basket and ringing it up. And so the end, it's kind of interesting because the closing scene has an adding machine in it. That's really unique. You know, it's got the Christmas tree and it's got the piano, but it also has an adding machine. And the accountant's sitting there ringing in the numbers and going chunk, chunk, and so, again, it closes with the scene of how logic and numbers can be used in an idealistic moral way. And that's a kind of, what I'm arguing for is that that's a kind of archetype of thinking. It's not about the role that people can play, but it's about a kind of an ideal that's sort of born in your mind. And we all know people who really seem to have that very strongly in their personality. We're going to run out of time. We want to get to the last one, feeling.
Yeah, we're coming down to our final minute. What's the best way to get your book, and so we don't get cut off before we tell them that again?
Okay.
Is Amazon the best place?
Well, Amazon, Barnes & Noble. I understand that it's on iTunes. If you have if you're an Apple person, you can get it through that. There are various other digital booksellers, Kobo, but most people just go to Amazon, and that's fine. Right now, the ebook is on sale for $2.99 for the month of November, so it's a great time to pick up the ebook and then think about whether you'd like to give ebooks or real books for Christmas. Give it a chance.
Mm. Remodeling the Mind, Ruth Johnson. Well, we're down to our last few seconds, Ruth. What do you want to leave us with? Time goes by so quick. Do you want to maybe tell us what your example was for feelings and we can just research it?
I will. I'll do it real fast. Feeling is about relationships. It's treating relationships in an ideal way and having an inborn sense of how people ought to love. And I was going to talk about two movies, Pay It Forward and Gosford Park, which was sort of the surprise one that I thought about, because it looks like it should be about finding truth because it's a murder mystery. But when you really look at how it's solved, it's all about relationships and about people putting others before them and who loves, you know, in different ways. And so it really is putting forward a message about an ideal, wonderful way to love people. And that's really the fourth thing that can be sort of an animal instinct, inborn thing in someone's personality.
Mm. Well, it was fun hanging out with you when we were teenagers, Ruth, and it was fun hanging out with you on the radio today.
I enjoyed it very much. I wish I could have talked a little faster because I love talking about Gosford Park, but thank you. And,
maybe we'll do a part two down the road, and we can get on that one.
That would be cool. That would be cool.
And blessings to you and your sister, Ellen. I remember having dinner with you and your sister when we were teenagers at your house, and to your wonderful father, who's a pastor and been a great pastor in the Pennsylvania area. And thank you again, Ruth.
Thank you, Rich. Have a great day.
Oh, you too, Ruth. And thank you to all of you for listening today to Richard Rossi Live. Go with God and be blessed.